Good afternoon, and welcome to Dearborn Open Mic, the last session of the year, 2019. So we are excited about hosting this last session of this year. We have had 12 sessions so far this year in the Dearborn Open Mic English, and we had 12 sessions in the Dearborn Open Mic Arabic called Al-Muntada Al-Thaqafi Fi Dearborn, both are programs by the Arab American Center for Culture and Arts. And we would like to thank all the volunteers and the participants who have made this possible. Dearborn has been known as one of the highest concentration of Arabs outside the Arabic world. It's a very diverse city and very unique city, and many people visit it. It's a destination for visitors. But in so many cases, they come for the food, the food aspect of culture, maybe shopping aspect of culture. We wanted to make sure that Dearborn also has the intellectual output that people can also enjoy and visit. And we've done that since we started, me and Rifat, and many people joined us since 2016, right? 16? This year, just to give you an idea, we've published 330 works, performances, works of art from the open mics on social media and on YouTube channels, yani out there in the world. If you search for Arab American poetry, 10% of the search results will come from things that have been produced by Dearborn Open Mic. So we have been strongly walking towards our goal of actually creating content online that represents the intellectual output and expression of the Arab American life and thought. Today's program is a special program. We are actually dedicating the largest part of the program to the open mic, so to you, if you would like to participate in any way. The program will end once you don't have anything to share with us. But before we go to that section, we have promised you from the last month, and thanks for Professor Bouardi for cooperating, although it's a very busy time for professors and students. And you can see his look on his face. I think, you know, I owe you appreciation and gratitude for you coming today. But as we promised you last time, that the topic needed more discussion, so we're going to dedicate today for a discussion over the topic that was discussed last time. The topic was Trans Revolution, Syria in the Hearts of the Diaspora. And it was inspired, the topic was inspired by the current atmosphere of revolutions in the Middle East, more specifically in Lebanon and Iraq, or lastly, because there has been some movements in Algeria and Sudan earlier, in other parts.
And Yemen.
Yemen, if you want to call it a revolution, yeah, I mean, it's an extension of what has started long time ago. So we're going to start with a discussion with Dr. Bouardi. I'm going to reintroduce Dr. Bouardi to you today. And if you would like to listen to the lecture, it's available online. Dr. Bouardi is a professor of Arab American history in yes. Okay, so if I can't find it, I'm going to say that Dr. Andrade is a professor of Arab American history in the University of Michigan, Dearborn. I consider him as one of the top experts in Arab American history and immigration. He has a published book, and he's working on the second one. It is one of the most important books that talk about the history, our the correcting and redirecting the narration of the Arab American history. So within that atmosphere, we're going to continue the discussion of last time. And without further ado, Dr. Hani Bardi.
Thank you, Sam. Masikum bil khair. So here we are again. Last time I had 20 minutes to crunch about 70 years of history. So why don't I, since we have very limited time today too, let me summarize, kind of revisit what we, the highlights from the talk last time and refresh your memory and suggest things that we might discuss tonight briefly, albeit. So I'm trying to unwrap my head from grading. You're right about that. This is like, you know, a dramatic time for professors and students alike. And I can't help running through my mind the silly emails I receive and the responses I have to muster. My mom says, hi, I have to have an A because she wants me to go to medical school. So and then the onus is on me to live up to his mom's expectations. So Syria has been in the hearts of and minds in the Arab diaspora all over the world for the last 120 years at least. You might say since the outset of the exodus or migration of Syrians from the Levant, that's Palestine, Lebanon, Syria proper, you can add Iraq to that also, to the West, especially to the U.S. So in contravention to what you hear in the bulk of the studies on Arab immigration, they did bring with them more than their personal baggage. They brought with them their hopes and aspirations for a free, independent, functioning, modern Syrian state that would encompass Bilad al-Sham or natural Syria. Think of it as a geographical location extending from the western borders of Iraq all the way to the Mediterranean in the west, and from the Taurus Mountains or the borders of Turkey in the north, all the way down to Sinai in the south. That includes Palestine, as I mentioned, Lebanon, Syria, and Jordan. And they hit the ground running, so they did a lot of work. Formal, political, organized activities on behalf of Syria. This is new information that is thankfully gaining steam and attracting some attention, alas. And I was able to do that because I happen to have the most complete documents outlining those activities anywhere. Someone entrusted me with those papers. So I made a conscious decision to relocate, enroll in a doctorate program, having done my master's as a hobby, sell a business, a couple of businesses actually, and make a conscious decision to be poor, I guess, one I'm happy with. So spring forward to the present. I mean, you know, you can juxtapose or match every single major political event in the Middle East with a major political event, organized, formal political event here on this side of the Atlantic. I should mention, to anticipate some kind of a question or two, that early on in Arab American studies, you hear a lot about sectarianism, intra-Christian squabbles. Orthodox and Maronites squabbled a lot. I did my best to debunk that. In fact, it doesn't hold water when you look at the evidence in the original language, in the Arabic language. What it was is that one editor named Naum Mukarzal, editor of Al-Huda newspaper, was an agent for the French. That was about the size of it. The reason why we should mention that is that whereas sectarianism did not figure prominently in the lives of the early Arab Americans, now it's veering its ugly head in our community. In our communities. So the war in Yemen, the war in Syria and Iraq splintered our ranks, and now we can't even agree to disagree. So individually we're very successful, but as a group we face challenges we have never faced before in our lives. The reason why correcting the record, the historical record, is so imperative. so that we stop saying, oh, we were not a people before, oh, we were apolitical, oh, we could not organize and not care less about Syria or the old or the home country. That is not true. We always did, always did. Now the time that the time has come to kind of project our understanding of what democracy and statehood is, it is very important that we build on solid ground. And that begins with a re-narration of the history and correcting the record, so we don't build on a decay. So forward to the present, all those activities, and I don't have time to recount all of them. I look at the Arab Spring, or what's left of it, or what has been called the Arab Spring, as a picking up the slacks from where we left off right after World War I. Those borders we know as the Middle East are artificial, straight lines drawn by the edge of a ruler by Westerners. And the Arab Spring was about erasing all those straight lines and reuniting Arabs into a home as they're intended to be. Of course, what you have now is that it seems as if we've moved further away from that than we ever have before. And it's left for young people to kind of correct, bring us back on track and trek on towards unity and some kind of cohesive national life. That's why this conversation is important. I think I'll stop here and see if there's any...
Thank you, Dr. I'm going to open the discussion to the audience. If anyone would like to have a question.
I have some... Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Haney, and it's very subject dear to my heart personally. When I describe Lebanon, I describe Lebanon as a chaotic country that it was established by the French to stay chaotic, and actually I utilize the term. It's a bite from Syria, in Arabic, Netchi in Syria. And at the same time, it was established to stay chaotic, to be unsettled, to undermine the national security of the Syria in particular. I think Lebanon also have a problem, which I think the problem of Lebanon and maybe throughout the 11th, we have a problem with the identity. And we don't know whether we are Arabs, we're not, or we are, we belong to the Arabic community or not. We have all sorts of problems. So we have an identity crisis in Lebanon. I don't know what you... Especially that showed up in the collective and a cooperative agreements between religious groups in Lebanon. I don't know what you would say about that.
What's the question again? I'm sorry.
I'm saying the question is, what do you think? Is it, do you agree with me or not that Lebanon has an identity crisis, mm-hmm. in its own existence, and why it was why it was did exist, and I call it as a bite of from Syria. It was, should have never been a country to start with. So along what you're saying about the other, so I was going to say that my question would be: what do you, is this accurate? Do you agree? What can you expand on that?
Okay, let's see here. Does Lebanon have an identity crisis? Who of us doesn't these days? Lebanon is a core location for the genesis of Arab national thought. Al-Nahda came down from the Levant in the mid-19th century. Butros al-Bustani, Ibrahim al-Yazigi, you name it. Amin al-Rihani later on, Arab national thought as it crystallized in the late 19th century, was centered in the Levant, where when there was not much difference between Beirut And well, there was not much in Jordan at the time. Amman maybe had 2,000 people in it. Nablus, you want to say it? Damascus, Aleppo, Halab, with very, very strong ties to Baghdad, of course, and to Cairo. So what happened since then? So why do we find it very difficult to look at the world through the same color lens? You can credit this identity crisis to the French and their confessional system. When they came and they, you know, beginning with the, actually ending with the National Pact, after a lot of planning, they figured that they'll introduce some kind of scheme where the president is always a Christian, the prime minister is always a Sunni, the speaker of the house is always Shi'i. And this is what the young people in the streets are rebelling against right now. Because as long as you have these things, yeah, you will have structural fundamental divisions that are enshrined or written into the country's constitution that can, you know, fragment people whenever there is a crisis. Another factor is the intervention. I mean, when during the Lebanese Civil War, you had Israelis in there. The Palestinians were dislocated, ended up in Lebanon with a lot of weapons. The Syrians had a stake in the place. And the Lebanese themselves had to contend with a confessional system that pitted them one against the other. So yeah, Lebanon was actually a battleground for many, many interests. And it spilled into the makeup and the persona of the country. And I think it might be fair to say, I hope I'm not too optimistic, that those demonstrations in the street right now by young people attempt to transcend all of this and put it to the side and forge ahead as one country with one identity.
Just following up on Dr. Abbas' question on the question of Arabic identity, when it's questioned, how do you see the questioning of Arabic identity in some Lebanese groups?
By Lebanese groups? Well, in the past, I mean, you know, some horrible people used to say, I don't want to be too specific so we don't shift the focus here, that if you tell a lie and you prevent the other person from telling the truth, people will believe your lie. So we've been lied to for a very, very long time, especially in the West. So we were told that, hey, Lebanese is distinct from Arab. I don't know if you remember those days, but believe it or not, when I first came to the States, that was actually, if you remember the days of the Falange Party in Lebanon, and really tight connection to the Israelis, who, as a matter of fact, installed their own man after 1982, Bashir Jmeil, if you recall, who was killed shortly after. We were told that Christians and Muslims are distinct groups. And some people grew up with that. All of that burned itself out and was out of the way, faded away like a bad aftertaste. All of that is the work of the French and, you know, outside powers in Lebanon, which spilled over into Arab American life and influenced discourse on our history. All of that has to be deconstructed word by word, and the work is cut out for us. It's up to the new scholars to forge ahead with that. So what happened in the United States, and your question, by the way, has many layers of complexity to it. What I complain about often is, I don't complain, I'm doing something about it, is that the Arab, in the Arab American, is disappearing, replaced by heritage Arabs who have a very tenuous grasp, among the scholars that is, of what Arab narrative is, the nuances of the culture itself. And if they know 200 words in Arabic, they claim to be fluent in Arabic. And kudos to them for taking the time and the effort to be interested in our culture. But I see them in conferences saying, hey, I'm translating this, I'm translating that. And I say to myself, the hell you are. I mean, you have at best, if you're lucky, about fourth grade education level Arabic fluency. And that's nothing to sneeze at, yeah? But for some reason, they dominate the discourse. So what happened to the Arab? What happened to the Arabic language, which is the foundation of what it means to be an Arab American to begin with? For example, I mean, there are like a dozen books written by, you've heard of Gibran, Khalid Gibran, I'm sure, all of you, most of you. So he had like a core of friends around him and people you never heard of, Arabat al-Qalamiyya, which we intend to celebrate next year, their centennial anniversary. But his friends and their friends wrote extensively, wrote a lot, and wrote really well, by the way. So much so that they influenced the language itself. I mean, they came up with a new paradigm or a new idiom of, you know, accessible journalism Arabic, modern poetry. But most of all, they wrote about the day-to-day life in Lower West Side of Manhattan. That is the metadata of what it means to be an Arab American. An Arab in America before we became Arab Americans. Yeah? And in the course of collective action in behalf of Syria, we became Arab Americans structurally, that is. This is not unique, by the way. Other immigrant groups from Southern Eastern Europe had the same experience. So did the Irish. Fighting for their causes overseas pulled them together. And what really sealed the deal was World War II. By then, we fought in World War I and World War II. We gave more money per capita. We volunteered more people per capita for those two wars than any other immigrant group. That brought us closer to what it means to be an Arab American by definition. Yeah? Yet, we forgot about what it meant to be an Arab in America because we have not accessed all that literature to kind of gauge the texture and what was on people's minds. And if you read it, you'll find that there were many Arab feminists who were males writing about themselves. There is Mary Aziz Khoury, who is a potent, powerful author in Lower Manhattan that we know nothing about. Someone latched on to Afifa Karam because she wrote for the New Syrian World in English. She was a minor figure by comparison, to be honest with you. So we don't know enough about the Arab that came to America. Therefore, the Arabic language, Arab narrative, have become separated from the American experience. So you have an Arab American that is second, third generation, or a Westerner who's writing about us with authority without actually capturing the baseline of what happened and when. For a contiguous narrative, you begin with that, then you apply the theories. You don't superimpose theories about race and ethnicity that is a Western elitist discourse onto Arabs in the United States. So complex issues, all of them overlap to obscure who we are as Arab Americans until we speak in our own voice. Thank you. Any more questions?
You know, I have a comment. I don't know if it's a question or not. But the
narrative I learned growing up, I came to this country, I was about 18. Is this working?
Yes. You came at age 18.
I was 18, yes. Yeah. The history I learned, you know what they teach us in Lebanon, you know, the Ottoman Empire and the progress of the, how the borders were created and all that. So to make a long story short, I learned that the reason the French created the Lebanese borders or to protect the minorities, which are the Christians, from the Ottoman-like abuse, oppression, and so forth. That was the vision. And until this day, that's my understanding of the reason why the borders were created. Like, why did they slice Lebanon out of Syria? In order to give the Christian minority in homeland where they can I mean, that's what I learned, right? That was
sure,
my reality.
Yeah, I didn't mean to. I'm sorry, go ahead.
One last comment. As far as who we are, I had a DNA done, and I'm 20% from North Africa. I mean, it's amazing. And the rest of it scatters all over the world, from all of the, mostly the Middle East, obviously.
Yeah.
But I even have some from the Philippines. So maybe one of these days, I'm sure this is when the Mughals came to the Middle East and conquered the Middle East, there's some traces left, or there's a 0.1% or so. So hopefully one day humans will get to a point where they will think of ourselves as humans and this planet, sort of like this border and that, and create these like, I like the way you said borders that were created by the edge of a ruler. You know, maybe one day we'll grow to just be human beings and... Anyway. Yeah.
I don't know if there's a question there. But.
No. Well, let me, I'd like to give you a brief answer and challenge the young people, not challenge you, but invite you to ask a question or whatever is on the, on your minds. I'd love to hear from you. Beginning with your last comment about the DNA test, that is no barometer for identity. Identity is acquired through experience, through narrative, collective memory, has nothing to do with DNA. If you go back to DNA, I mean, if you DNA Jesus Christ, who knows what he might turn out
he's
to be? And if you DNA Palestinian, actually, here's a joke for you very quickly. One of our friends who's like Mr. Palestinian did that same thing. He came back 37% Jewish. And why not? So it's a cultural identity. Yeah, this is the beauty of being an Arab is that it is a cultural identity. The only reliable marker of which is your tongue, your mother tongue. If your mother tongue is Arabic, you can say I'm an Arab. I met like a Korean Palestinian kid. He asked him, where are you from? He says, I'm from Beit Jala, in a Beit Jala accent. So there you go. As for the creation of Lebanon, it's a long story. So there were like a lot of pressure on the Ottomans to modernize. Among those, we talked about this briefly last time, which is the capitulations, economic treaties, but also redistricting. So in the course of modernizing, the Ottomans decided to start collecting taxes. So they created counties. One of those counties was Mutasarrafiyat Beirut. That's more or less is the border of modern Lebanon. They just, the French said, oh yeah, this will be an enclave for Christians and we're going to protect them. But the core question is, did they need protection? The answer is definitively no. Yeah. And within that mutasarrafia, they drew haphazardly, by the way. And if I sound like a Muslim, I'm not. I don't want to pretend to be, but that's beside the point here, right? So majority were Muslims, but that was ignored. That's why you didn't have a census in Lebanon since 1943, even if you had an accurate one then. The Muslims were a majority throughout. But the French wanted to secure a zone of direct influence, which they expanded to include Syria later on, with a buffer zone between them and the British. And the British did the same thing with Palestine, with another buffer zone extending all the way to the Arabian Gulf or the Persian Gulf. Yeah? So this way they can connect their Europe, you know, their homelands, to their very wealthy colonies in the Far East. Mm-hmm. So if you connect the Mediterranean and the Arabian Gulf, this is a straight shot all the way to India and China from there right away. Beyond that, you have to go through the Suez Canal, which was not dug up yet until 1869, I think, something like that. So you'll have to sail around the entire Horn of Africa to go to Asia. So that was our curse, is that we are in occupied, one of the most, although I don't like to use the word occupy, obviously, but we are located in one of the most coveted locations on the planet. We are the key between Europe and Asia. And now it's your turn, guys. What's on your minds? I never do this to my students, by the way, just for the record. I'm just wondering if any of this resonates or... Yeah, please.
You were mentioning some voices, like in...
My name's Eli. I'm from California. You were mentioning like some different voices, like in Lower Manhattan, like in the early Arab American community, that you felt like were ignored or that needed more like scholarly emphasis on them. Who are some other like people that you feel like in the early Arab American community who like need more work done on them and like how their views influence the development of like Arab American activism, yeah, or historical narratives and the like?
Here's a name for you, Rizq Haddad. You probably never heard of him. One other name is Abbas Abu Shara. Has anyone here heard of Abbas Abu Shara? It's not a fair question because I think he left the United States in the late 1930s. But he was, if I have to put him on a scale compared to Gibran and others, he scores right up there next to Gibran. This man lived in Highland Park. He was the executive secretary of the New Syria Party. from 1925 until 1927. And he was the one who wrote poetry celebrating the life and later the death of Butros al-Bustani and the guy who, and also the Bustani who translated the Iliads, celebrated the life and the death of, Sharif of Mecca, Hussein, who was very popular among the Syrians, and his son Faisal, who was, became the king of Syria for a short time. Anyway, in those, he also posited an account of what life was like in Highland Park. But he was also known all the way in New York. And what's lost in the shuffle, for example, if we talk about him or someone like him from the period, or Farah in Flint, Michigan, for that matter, born 1888, came to Flint in 1913, you will be rediscovering what life was like in Highland Park, which was the most major hub of Arabs in the West outside New York. Yeah, we pretend to know things about it. They could care less about working for Uncle Henry in the Ford factory. And their story is a little bit more complex. They issued several newspapers. Al-Hayat was one of the latter ones. Al-Difa' al-Arabi, we know nothing about. There was Al-Bayan and several newspapers published in Highland Park that we know little about. But their cultural life and social life was very vibrant, highly organized, and they laid the seeds for what Dearborn has become, the largest concentration of Arabs outside the Middle East. Why? Why Dearborn? Because of these guys. So we did not even address the question, why Dearborn? Why did it become such a large concentration? It was like relatively few people in Highland Park, per capita, let's say, compared to other immigrants, or the huge number, relatively speaking, of Arabic speakers in Manhattan, lower Manhattan, in Little Syria, in Manhattan, the original colony there. But their impact on Arab American life is huge. We know next to nothing about them because we haven't even read what they used to write in their newspapers and in books and magazines and published overseas, as a matter of fact. Thanks.
Any more questions? I think we can take one more.
I actually just did a report on this about the way that Lebanon's government was set up and how they had different religions assigned to different places in parliament. Why would France set that up? Were they trying to, not that by any means Lebanon has failed, but create that conflict within Lebanon to begin with, if they're going to start out with that flaw in the system, of course? It'd be like putting Democrats and Republicans as vice president and president. Like, you see how Congress works now. It doesn't. So why would you put that up that high in government so early on? And they don't even use that system themselves.
Well, they found it very convenient to adapt the Maronites because Maronism is an offshoot of Catholicism. France is a Catholic country. So this was their excuse, on the face of it, that is. But the real breadth of their schemes in Lebanon was political. It's all about carving out a sphere of influence. So in the course of doing so, they had to work out a deal with the British. And the deal they made was called Sykes-Picot. And if you look at the Sykes-Picot agreement, it is almost exactly matches the political map of the Middle East today. With one adjustment, you draw a line to end like where Jordan is, which became Transjordan later on, separate from Palestine. And the French and the British made like a business deal. So the French said, look to the British, we'll give you northern, what became Iraq, Mosul, and all that oil, Kirkuk and all of that. You give us $20 million and a percentage every year. So the line went up to delineate the borders of Syria, and that's it. The rest is down the line, Sykes-Picot. And you can look it up and find it in the map. So that's the French. That's why the French did what the French did.
Do they still get that 20 million?
Well, this is like probably paid off by now. So, and the British expanded and they found even more oil in Iran and they put their hand on that. Although it was around the same time they established their oil interest in Iran. So that's around that time they were converting from coal in the, on the ships, which used most of the oil and machinery, to combustion motors, where you capture all the energy and converting to oil, mixture of oil and coal, and then to oil strictly. So they needed the oil. So that was a lock. That was it. So if you're in Lebanon, and if the British are in Palestine, they can protect the Suez Canal, and they said as much. And Zionism benefited from that because they said, hey, we'll be your guys here, among other things. And they can also protect their interests in terms of energy sources like oil. And later on, the Americans muscled in on the act in Saudi Arabia, and you know the rest. The Gulf, the first Gulf War, second Gulf War, all of that is, people go to war for only a couple of reasons. You know, one of them is prestige, one is strategic locations, strategic concerns, and oil is one of them.
Thank you, Dr. Professor Gordy.
Pleasure.
We have a podcast. Thank you very much. We have a podcast titled Arab American Identity with Dr. Bordy on Dearborn Blog. We are at the fourth episode. You can catch it on iTunes or on YouTube. It's available and will continue, hopefully, in next year. So now, is the as we said, that we're dedicating today for the open mic section. And we have a sign-up sheet over there. Everyone is welcome to contribute with a short story, with a poem. And please just sign up. So the first.
First participant.
And thank you, Jessica, for making it this time, like we asked you last time. Jessica Khreizat will read for us Gravity and Season. Thank you.
Hello. Good to be back. I am reading these two poems that I intended to read last month, but I chickened out. So this is, I guess, round two of trying. So here is Gravity. Your phone's ready. Okay. I love the moon, but tonight it is crushing me. Tonight it is illuminating every hard thought, every horrible thought, everything I thought I stopped feeling. Gravity tends to sleep with the clock in my mind. It tends to laugh at my work, at the construction site that's still tearing down and rebuilding my walls. It tends to make my body a ship, my brain an iceberg. It tends to have them fall into each other, loudly, like thunderous streams that say, I'm stronger than you are. Gravity tends to pull at the heartache, at the thoughts I try to bury but can't bury, the worries I try to work through but can't work through. You see, gravity likes to sit on top of the chaos I can't kill. It likes to mock the writing on the wall, the writing that pleads with tranquility to show herself. It tries to hold me like it's the only thing that will ever want to hold me, like it's the only reality that will ever listen to the storm I have inside. It sometimes succeeds at blocking the beauty around me, the beauty inside my chest, the beauty that lies in fighting after the fall, because it knows I tend to fall into myself, out on the pavement of who I was and who I want to be. When it's awake in my head, gravity tries to move me away from who I am. It wants to control what I believe. And so tonight I can't look at the moon, because tonight I'm the one that has to fight for my own peace. Thank you. Okay, and then I have one more. This is called Season. I wrote it right when the leaves were starting to change and fall, so it's pretty dramatic. But here we go. What season are you today? I want to know before I stand in your vicinity. I need to know before I call your name. What season are we in today? Is it the end or the beginning? Is this the transition? Is this the transition or how the leaves will be for a while? I need to know. But more than this, I need to know why you think it's okay to move like a season, to change like the weather when you are a man, made of flesh and stone. You are a man made of your own desires, your own truth. People weren't made to idolize and replicate seasons, to turn cold out of the blue. Not even summer should change like that. It's unnatural, a sign that something is wrong. So I want to know why you try to make the earth spin faster, why you reach me to leave me, why a month of silence means nothing but the falling of time, of leaves, of people drifting in the wind like a draft filling up an empty room. I want to know what happened, what keeps happening in the times we are apart. I want to know why you only love me when I'm far, out of reach, in an idea, in a scream, standing on the tip of your tongue. I want to know why you keep me balanced with adoration and indifference. I want to know what season you've become. Is it the time of year that you'll want me? Or the time of year when you don't know how to care, so you care less? Right now, I can't tell if you're the sun that sets or the one that beats through the dark. I can't tell if your intentions are orange and blue, red or yellow. I can't tell what season you are. It just feels like winter has come early this year. Thank you.
The final call for more sign-ups. If you would like to participate with storytelling, with short story, something that happened with you in 2019 that you'd like to share with us, something that inspired you in 2019, some of your resolutions for next year, or anything that you've written and you'd like to share with us, this is the mic for that. Before I introduce you to Ali Subah, or introduce Ali Subah to you, I'd like to share a poem with you called When You Are There. When you are there, your eyes steal every moment. I feel I'm dancing with you every second, even if I'm sitting. Your smile tickles me, and your bright eyes whisper to me the secret of lonely nights. Your fragrance diffuses through everything and arrests me. Your hair seems to entangle the veins surrounding my heart. When you are there, my night grows long and tireless. Time melts on your nails as black polish. When you are there, I feel I otherwise very seldom do, that I too am there. Thank you. Ali Salah.
It's really good to be here. So this past 2-3 weeks, I've been working really hard on an album, a musical album for hip hop. And these past 2 days, I've clocked in like 11 hours at the studio. So like really intense working. Just last night, we finished everything. So in about a week and a half, it'll be out. So I'm gonna share 2 songs from the album today. And is everyone cool with cuss words? Because if someone isn't, I won't perform one of them, but let me know if that's okay with everyone. We're good? Cool.
This is a lot of hard beat.
I forget the lyrics for a minute. One second, I just want to make sure. Okay, no, I actually got that. Hold on, let me check. I'll show you where I'm in this part. Attach this part. say I'm picture perfect, but I think that you're fine. Like if I showed you my flaws, would you start running? Not even in the mood to stop outside. Too many eyes staring makes me wanna hide. I don't like it when my friends feel pity. For me, I'd rather move from the city. You ask what's wrong, the answer is far from pretty. Far do you get me? Far away is where I'll stay. Until this meditation does the job. Meditating, trying to turn the knob. Open the door to a room full of flowers by myself. I love it when they bloom. I love it when you're here next to me. Pointing out that bitterness gets the best of me. Helping me with life and the journey. But I hate it when you're gone. My vision gets blurry. Call me when you get a chance in a hurry. You always seem to be my guidance. Showing me there's still beauty in the silence. Always gonna be my partner in crime. I know you're confused. Just give me some time. And I'll keep it a thousand with you if you keep it a hundred. You say I'm picture perfect, but I think that you're frontin'. Like if I showed you my flaws, would you start ducking? Or if I showed you my claws, would you start running? What if I ran out of money? How about making you laugh? What if I couldn't be funny? And I'll keep it a thousand with you if you keep it a hundred. You say I'm picture perfect, but I think that you're frontin'. Like if I showed you my flaws, would you start running? Thank you.
Recite one of your poems.
Yeah, which one do you want me to do?
You pick.
Okay.
Do you don't need a video?
No, I don't. No,
I actually guess. I'm trying to find it, but I don't think I have it in my notes. I have it written down. Yeah, I would
love to do that one. Yeah, but I don't think I have it in my notes. What about a love poem? A heartbreak poem? Okay, cool. Maybe the stars might get a chance to kiss you before I do. And maybe the world might end while I'm still chasing you. You have become now my religion. I have and will worship you forever. But I am far from heaven, the place that I call home. The only place that lays within me. You carry a place underneath your skin. When you left, my happiness followed you. And so I will always follow you, hoping my happiness chases to stop letting its hands sit to your back and can finally come back to me. My happiness was an old friend that wanted to be your friend as soon as it met you. The kid that used to run freely in the fields of life is now running to leave it. But every now and then, when I am at the border of leaving the fields of life, I meet you once more. And my happiness peeks from your shoulder and waves at me. And your smile promises better days. And for those few moments, I feel life flourishing within me for the first time in a long time. So maybe I don't need to call you mine to be happy. I can wave back at my happiness every time I see you. And maybe that'll be enough for me.
Thank you.
All right, last call. Any participation? Okay, I have a poem. I'm going to participate with it from 2019. And it's about, it was inspired on the day that Assange was arrested, the founder of WikiLeaks. Anyone likes to participate, please feel free to step up. You do. Are you ready? Sorry to put you on the spot. We'll give you a minute to prepare. We have Adil Muzib who likes to participate or something. Sorry, for some reason I lost it. Okay, I'm gonna maybe recite another one, or you're ready to look for it. Okay, Adin Muzib.
First of all, thank you so much for having me today. I do software development for a living, so it's kind of weird to stand in this, behind this mic. I also serve on the Board of Education for Dearborn Schools and Henry Ford College. So as I was coming here, I was actually listening to NPR, and they have the impeachment hearings on. And I was like, what would it be? Yeah, they're actually doing it right now. So pretty much, yeah. Every representative is saying where they stand. So most likely that they would render a vote tonight or tomorrow. So, Dr. Bowerdy, thank you. I'm sorry I wasn't able to attend your session. Obviously, with having two kids, that's kind of a struggle to be in all places at once. And today it was a crazy day at work. So it's at the end of the year. You need to get all of your checkboxes done. So thank you once again, Wissam, and to Dearborn Open Mic for this opportunity. I would like to recite here a translation of a poem. So I heard this poem probably a decade ago, and it's by the Palestinian-Egyptian poet, Tamim al-Barghouti. And I've been listening to it, obviously in Arabic, in his own voice for about a decade. And I was like, what would it be if I translate it to English? So if you excuse me, I can do the Arabic first, and then I can do the English, or English, and then Arabic. Okay, Arabic first. All right. So obviously, this poem, he first publicly delivered it at the Amir Shu'ara, so the Prince of Poets. And this was a competition that started this whole thing in the Arab world. And unfortunately, because he had so many amazing competitors, he came in second place in that competition. But And by the way, first place was a Yemeni guy, but I still believe that Tamim deserved first place. So here comes the poem. The poem is called Ishi Sa'atan. And I translate it as stand for 1 hour. But when I actually talked to Miss Hela Sharara, she was like, maybe pause for 1 hour might be a better translation. And she told me translation is difficult, and I recognize that. It's the most difficult job a person can have. If you watch Al Jazeera, probably you would hear how the person kind of reiterates every word and tries to recollect themselves. It's a machine, especially if you're doing it. I mean, I envy these guys who, especially they do it for footballers or for any kind of sports where the person is talking and live translation is going on. So here he goes. لفي ساعة لفي ساعة يفديك قولي وقائله ولا تخذلي من بات والدهر خاذله أنا عالم بالحزن منذ طفولتي أنا عالم الحزن منذ طفولتي رفيقي فما أخطيه حين أقابله وإن له كفا إذا ما أراحها على جبل ما قام بالكف كاهله يقلبني رأسا على عقب بها كما أمسكت ساق الوليد قوابله ويحملني كالصقر يحمل صيده ويعلو به فوق السحاب يطاوله فإن فر من خلابه راح هالكا وإن ظل في مخلابه فهو آكله عزائي من الظلام إن مت قبلهم كذلك ما ينجو من الموت قاتله فنحن ذنوب الموت وهي كثيرة وهم حسنات الموت حين تسائله يقوم بها يوم القيامة مدافعا وفي رواية قالها يقوم بها يوم الحساب مدافعا يرد بها ذمامه ويجادله ولكن قتلى في بلادي كريمة ستبقيه مفقود الجواب يحاوله ترتفع من تحت الجدار مناديا أبي لا تخف والموت يهطل وابله ووالده رعبا يشير بكفه وتعجز عن رد الرصاص أنامله أرى الموت لا يرضى سوان فريسة لكنا لعمري أهله وقبائله لنا ينسج الأكفان من لنا ينسج الأكفان في كل ليلة لخمسين عاما نوتس 70 عاما مات كل مغازل وقتلى على شط العراق كأنهم نقوش بساط دقق الرسم غازله يصلى عليه ثم يوطأ بعدها ويحرف عنه عينه متناوله إذا ما أضعنا شامها وعراقها فتلك من البيت الحرام مداخله أرى الدهر لا يرضى بنا حلفاؤه ولسنا مطيقيه عدوا نصاوله فهل ثم من جيل يأتي أو مضى يبادلنا أعمارنا ولواده. So, obviously, translating a poem from the beautiful Arabic language loses a lot of the beautiful meanings. So, I'm sorry for those who only know English, because when you translate something in any text from its original language, and especially the beautiful Arabic language, it loses sometimes the meanings, and there's a saying, loss in the translation. And the beautifulness and the sweetness of the meanings, the deep meanings that go into it. And obviously this poem by Tamim still kind of, as you look at the Arab world and as you look at the entire world, it's kind of telling you every year, every month, it's the same story that he's telling. فَنَحْنُ دُنُوبُ الْمَوْتَ وَهِيَ كَثِيرَةٌ وَهُمْ حَسَنَاتُ الْمَوْتَ وَهِيَ مُتْبَعْدُونَ. So it's amazing of how Tamim really is, he's a genius in poetry, I would think, in modern poetry. So here comes the English part. So he said, pause for an hour, or stand for an hour. My words and their narrator shall be a sacrifice for you. And don't let down whom time has let down. I've known sorrow since my childhood. He, sorrow, is my friend. I can't pass him when I face him. And that he has enough of a palm, if he rests it on a mountain, the palm won't be overbitten. He turns me upside down, like a newborn's leg clings to the midwife. He carries me like a falcon, carrying his catch, lifting it up above the clouds. So if the catch falls from the eagle's claws, it wrecks. And if it stays in those claws, the falcon will eat it. I'm afraid that the oppressors might die before me. Full of death, it does not distinguish. When death approaches the killed, therefore the killer won't escape death either. Indeed, we are the sins of death, and they are many, and they are the virtues of death. When you ask him, he comes off on the day of reckoning as an advocate. He responds to his critics and argues with them, but those killed in my country who were gracious will keep him unable to find any answers. Even if he tries, you see the child under the wall calling, then don't be scared. Dad, don't be scared, as death heavily pours, and his father horrified, waving his hand, unable to block the bullets with his fingers. I see beauty didn't help the beautiful. And since when the killed is protected by morals, on the news bulletin every night, we see our death rise and loom. Coffins are waved for us every night for 50 years. It's death spindles never wears off. I see death finding no one but us to prey on. I see death finding no us but to prey on, as if we're like its family and its tribes. And those killed in the Iraq beach, as of like embossed mat, and art has perfected the sewing, using it to prey on the deceased, and then it's put down. And his eyes turns away from his reach. If we lose the Levant and Iraq, as those the entrances to the Haram, I see time not willing to be our ally, nor capable to be its enemy to fight it. Perhaps there might be a generation forthcoming or already past that would exchange us our time with theirs. Thank you.
Actually, I made a video, so I took his video
and I put it at the translation. So if you'd like to check it out, it's shabadel.com, S-H-A-B-A-D-E-L. It's my blog, and I post sometimes translations of other poems and other politics stuff that I come across. So I would love to have you as a subscriber. Thank you.
Thank you, Adil. The mic is still open, and we have more time. I will read you a poem while you contemplate participating. This poem is called The Day of the Arrest of Assange, when he was arrested in London. The day of the arrest of Assange, I was there. I saw the anger in his eyes. I saw the face of despair. He acted when he saw injustice, the guardian of information, the destroyer of secrets, the voice of the oppressed. He whistleblowed corruption, and with his words and courage nurtured victims. He spoke, this is taken by the way from their mission statement. He spoke when no one dared to speak, a David facing 1,000 Goliaths, and knew that when we know what we know is everything, and how we use that knowledge is what we ought to be. He understood the mastery of fear, but he was dragged today in the streets of London, and I, passively, was there. Thank you. With that, it's the end of Dearborn Open Mic for 2019. Happy New Year, and we'll see you. And for January, we're skipping 1 week, so it will be basically the fourth. It will be the fourth Wednesday of January. We are reformatting the program a little bit, both in the Arabic and the English. So expect exciting things. And all of you are invited to become members of the Arab American Center for Culture and Arts, arabamericancca.org, and you can fill the application there. Or if you go to dearbornblog.com, the links are all there. Thank you again. All the videos will be on dearbornblog.com. Thank you.
I'm sorry, I didn't bring a mirror.
I'm sorry. I don't want to go through this again.